I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Portland State University is in the heart of downtown Portland, Oregon. It flanks the city's gracious park blocks, it's the terminus for the city's streetcar line, and it's taking a leading role in the city's sustainability and economic development success. Today, we'll talk to PSU President Vim Vivel on his partnership with Mayor Sam Adams and the university's role as an anchor institution. And we'll talk with Marilyn Yank from the Little Sparrow Farm in New Orleans. Of the many exciting stories of reconstruction coming out of post-Katrina New Orleans is the surge in urban farming. We'll ask Marilyn about the difference between gardening and urban agriculture and find out how growing your own food gives you a better relationship to what you eat. All that, plus the latest from Plant Edison and our City Views commentator Walker Smith, coming up after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. My first guest is Vim Vivel, the president of Portland State University. PSU is a large urban research university in the heart of downtown Portland, Oregon. And as its president, Vim has important insights on how public universities can be part of the economic and social life of a city. Vim, you are an experienced university leader. What makes Portland State different from other universities?
Well, there's probably a bunch of ways in which we are different, but there are also many ways in which we are similar, which suggests to me that what we do, many other universities could be doing as well. One of the ways in which we're different is that Portland State has a very long history of being deeply involved with its city. We were started in 1946 to serve returning veterans. And initially, the campus was just supposed to be sort of a temporary thing that would go away once those veterans went away. And some of our sister universities didn't particularly like this new urban upstart. And that's a history, by the way, that's repeated at places like University of Illinois Chicago Circle, where the flagship campus didn't really want an urban competitor. But in order to survive there, for Portland State had to show its value and create very close alliances with the local political, labor, business community, and always be deeply engaged with its environment. It couldn't be a university, you know, up on a hill. So we have been deeply engaged with our city since the beginning. Another way in which Portland State is really pretty unique is that we have driven the notion of being an engaged urban institution deep into the curriculum. In the 90s, we created what was called the Inquiry Program, where our students, as part of their graduation requirements, have to do a project that's called the Senior Capstone that is a partnership project with a community organization, a local business, or an arm of government. So all of our students absolutely will be doing a project that puts them in immediate collaboration in a joint project with a community organization. A final way in which I would say we are different is that Portland State is the only really large university in the Portland region. There are no other public universities, and the private universities that are here are very nice, but they're very small. So in many ways, we are it. And that does make it, I will admit, easier to be a partner and easier for many businesses and other organizations to turn to us because there's really nobody else quite here.
It's interesting when you talk about engagement and you, for instance, cite the Inquiry Program. Expand on that. When a university president starts talking deep engagement, what should the community expect from that university?
Engagement really expresses itself in a whole variety of ways. Now, the main activities of a university, of course, are teaching, research, service, but we're also an economic entity that runs buildings and facilities and purchases and hires people. So if you're going to be engaged, you have to think as an institution about all of those aspects of the organization. I already talked about how we do it through the curriculum and in many other ways in the curriculum. Obviously, our graduate students do internship projects. Our social work and education students are always doing internships with the schools and so on. The second one is through our research. While our faculty, like any faculty in the country, are free to choose their own research agenda, over the years, we have attracted faculty who are really excited about the idea of being at a university that really cares deeply about its urban environment, and where many of our faculty take the research questions that they pursue from what they see around them. So they focus on sustainability, on public transportation, on homelessness, on the environment, as well as on working with companies like Nike. One thing you may know is that it's a Portland State student who developed the famous Nike swoosh. You know, that's a form of engagement that perhaps we don't always immediately think about, but that's about relating to your local business community.
I'm interested in the latest version of your economic development plan for Portland State University. I think it's very interesting that you've developed a plan that is in complete alignment with the City of Portland's economic development strategy. In fact, you go to great lengths to explain where the university currently is engaged in activities that will further the city's economic development strategy and in ways you intend to. It's quite a meshing of a university agenda with a city's agenda. How did that happen?
I think it builds on the long history that I described. We didn't just sort of suddenly think about, well, wouldn't this be a nice idea? No, it comes out of years of collaboration, having good relationships with people, working together on all kinds of projects. So you begin to really get a sense that we as a university are an integral part of the well-being of this institution. My first strategic goal as a university president, we have five strategic themes, but the first one that we talk about is provide civic leadership through partnerships. That's the first thing we focus on. And therefore, to work with the Portland Development Commission, which is the main economic development agency for the city, is a very natural consequence of this. We do this both through thinking about how our curriculum meshes with the economic development priorities. You know, the city has identified clean tech and sustainability as one of the clusters. We as a university have identified sustainability as the key intellectual hallmark of what brings together our faculty. And we received a $25 million grant from the Miller Foundation just a year ago to help us make this a reality. So we're very real and very serious about that. Active wear and design is the second cluster, because Portland is the home of both Nike and Columbia and other sportswear companies. Software, Intel is the largest employer in Oregon. And so there's obviously a lot of both hardware and software, and our IT department works with that. Advanced manufacturing, we're working very closely with the metals industry, companies like Boeing and PCC Structurals, as well as in the biosciences, which is a huge growth area for us. The other big way in which we collaborate on economic development is, of course, simply by our presence in the city. We are a large university. We have 28,000 students. We have an economic impact of about $1.2 billion. But more than that, we are a very clear physical presence right at the edge of downtown. It's because of our presence that that part of the city really looks wonderful now. It's very attractive. It's both green in the literal sense, a lot of new buildings that have both been rehabilitated or newly built, and a huge amount of vitality around the campus. That is a key way, because we know that successful cities are the cities with a vibrant downtown. And we know that if you have a vibrant downtown, your city as a whole is going to be successful. But a final piece that I really want to talk about is that we have done this by focusing on sustainability. Of all of our students, faculty, and staff, 65%, a full 65%, come to campus in something other than private automobile. They come by public transportation. They come by bicycle. That is amazing. For a while, I was at another university, the University of Baltimore, which is actually located similarly to Portland State, just on the edge of downtown, near light rail, near the subway, on bus lines, and by commuter rail. And there, only 6% of the students, faculty, and staff use something other than private automobile. It is just amazing. And indeed, we have the four busiest transit stops in the whole TriMet system are located on our campus.
That's astonishing. Let's talk a minute, a related subject, this eco district that you are proposing, which I think is very compelling. I mean, it's packaged well. And let's talk about your plans for the eco district and how you're thinking about that.
An eco district, just in case people don't know, it's the idea of having a neighborhood where you really focus a lot of sustainability-related programs and projects. So the idea is that it's a neighborhood that is resource efficient, that captures and manages and reuses a majority of energy, water, and waste on the site, that is home to a range of transportation options, that provides a rich diversity of habitat and open space, but also enhances community engagement and well-being. We're now in the process of planning five eco-districts in Portland, and our campus will be one of them, or most of our campus will be one of them. The highlight of the district will be the home for the Oregon Sustainability Institute. It will be a joint project for several universities and a coalition of about 40 not-for-profit organizations that are involved in sustainability activities will be housed there. The building aims to be the largest and first successful living building. We're going to win the Living Building Challenge, which means a building that processes all of its waste on site, all of its water on site, and it is truly a net zero building. It will require people to live and use the building very differently. Obviously, you're talking about a lot of shared space, about using technology differently. It's a big challenge, and it's a joint project between Portland State, the state of Oregon, the city, and a lot of not-for-profit partners. So it also exemplifies, of course, that you can't do these things alone, that they're truly partnership projects, and we hope indeed that the federal government will be a partner as well. But in addition to that building, the streets around it already are being redeveloped to really be models of how stormwater is managed. There will be lots of green spaces. We will work on sustainable industry development in these areas as well, so that it will really become a district model. And the other piece of it is we will do a lot of research around it. We will monitor, we'll measure, because we will learn a lot about how you can do this and what are the advantages, really, of aggregating these kinds of activities.
Universities in recent years have been in a struggle with municipalities on what they should pay the municipality for the services they are provided. I'm curious where you come down on this. I mean, do you think universities owe the municipality some fee for service that it costs to service their students? Or do you think the contribution of universities is so apparent to cities that, in fact, they are paying their fair share without paying taxes per se?
Maybe we've just been particularly fortunate. On my first day of work, just over 14 months ago now, I rode my bike into work together with Mayor Sam Adams of Portland. And I think that joint bike ride exemplified and symbolized both the collaborative nature between city government and the university and, of course, our joint commitment to sustainability. When I was being hired, there was an arrangement for me to be interviewed by the mayor, which, again, exemplifies how seriously the university takes its collaborative nature. And the mayor told me, I want you to buy as much land as you can. I want you to build as many buildings as you can. And I want you to build as many student beds as you can. Because this mayor and this city understand how a university contributes to the economic vitality of the region. And never a word has been breathed about property taxes or pilot payments. Now, we are a serious contributor. all of our ground floor space is developed with commercial uses, retail stores and others. So, of course, we pay property taxes on that, and it contributes to the vitality. We're expanding our number of student beds, so those become customers for increased commercial development. We have made very large contributions to some of these transportation improvements. We just opened a new light rail line that runs by campus, but that goes all over the metropolitan area. And we contributed several million dollars as a capital contribution to make that line possible. And we will do the same thing with future lines. So you have to put your money where your mouth is. But I think some cities are short-sighted in looking only at sort of today's income and outflows and not realizing how critical the presence of a university is to the economic well-being of a region. But depending on the nature of the city and the number of universities there are, absolutely, universities have to expect to participate in providing the municipal services that are necessary. Just one example, there are some gorgeous, call them the park blocks, which are essentially, it's a boulevard that runs through the heart of our campus. It's city land, city streets, but it really functions as our campus green, and we maintain and pay for the maintenance of all that.
I did not know that. How did you decide that the transit system is an appropriate expenditure for the university where, let's say, safety may not be?
Well, we are a very safe campus, so we feel that we have that piece under control. But, you know, your question is certainly right. There are always other things one can do. And I'm sure that if I asked my English faculty or my biology faculty whether they think we should have provided $4 million for the light rail or should have given it to them to hire more faculty, they might have made a different decision than the one that we are making. For all universities, it's a balancing act. Obviously, having good public transportation saves us a lot of money because it means that we don't have to build parking garages. More importantly, I think it just how can we be serious in talking about sustainability and having that as a key focus of our research and teaching and what makes us globally outstanding if we then don't follow up and, again, put our money where our mouth is? That's the role of a university president and all the people working with them to make tough choices. There's never enough money. And just to put this in perspective, by the way, Portland and Oregon ranks 44th in the nation in its per capita subsidy for higher education. So I'm not speaking from a perch of a university with lots of money or a big endowment. Our endowment is about $30 million. It's nothing compared to large private institutions or indeed many public institutions. So these are indeed very tough choices for them, and you have to live your values.
Let me change the subject a minute with you, Vim. We don't have a lot of time left, but I want to ask you a few questions about the university's role in education, specifically the role of universities in improving K-12 education. It's universities that actually educate all of the educators, all the teachers, all the administrators. I mean, so what is it that's going wrong there in the teaching and training of educators if we're not happy with the performance of our K-12 schools? And what else should universities be doing?
Universities do absolutely have a critical role because we, as you say, because we train the teachers, but also, of course, because the students come out of K-12 and those are our students. In an area like where we are, where we are the largest public university, we know what happens at K-12. Ultimately, a lot of those people wind up at our doorstep. So that's why we are deeply engaged. It's only, I think, by working on a daily basis with the K-12 system, and one of the first things I did when I came a year ago is establish a joint task force between Portland State and the Portland Public Schools to deeply investigate where could we do a better job and where could we help them do a better job. And it's very clearly based in the idea that we both have areas where we need to improve. It's not just one or the other. And our dean of education, Randy Hitz, has been deeply involved in thinking about the nature of their curriculum, the nature especially of the internships and the student teaching that his students do. So one of the changes we've made, for instance, is that now they're clustered in a limited number of schools so that they can then have a mentor on site who watches much more closely than was the case in the past, where you might have one student in, you know, one school and it was much harder to get a clear sense of what was really going on. But as universities, we have a huge responsibility. We are working with a coalition of business, public officials, involving the city, and all the school districts in the region to develop a very close and well-developed measurement system and metric system so we can really watch what is going on and how we can improve it. Along with that, we've established a task force on Hispanic student success. Portland and Oregon historically have been somewhat homogeneous, but that's very rapidly changing. About 25% of our student body at the K through 12 level now is a non-white, and that will increase to about 40% over the next 10 years. So there are a lot of new challenges for the school system. We're working very closely with them to address that.
Let me ask a somewhat related question. As you know, there are many adults in America with some college but no degree. What are you doing at Portland State University to serve adult students with some college and no completion, as well as get the students currently enrolled to complete?
Portland State has for decades, in fact, primarily served students like that. Our biggest source of students has always been transfer students that maybe at some point had some community college or had started college somewhere else. For whatever reason, it didn't work out. And now they are working, they have families. So we have classes at all hours of the day. Our change actually is that now increasingly we also serve more traditional students, you know, kids just out of high school starting as 18-year-olds and living on campus. But we have very good connections with the community colleges. So it's a very easy transition for people, even if they've gone to the community college some time ago, to figure out what their credits will be worth at Portland State. People like the fact that when they're in a classroom, they're not going to be the only one who is 30 years old or 35 years old or 40 years old. We have a mixture of all ages in our classes, and that alone is one very important thing. The other thing we're doing is greatly expanding our online options to serve those students, not to serve students in, you know, Timbuktu or Kansas or whatever. It's our own students who are working students, who have complicated lives and schedules, who need the online education to be able to take that class, you know, on Saturday evening at 10 o'clock when they have time, and not Tuesday and Thursday from 2 to 4 when traditionally faculty might have wanted to teach it. So those are among the ways. But a key thing there is creating a climate where people feel comfortable. It's very hard for 30-year-old returning students to sit in a classroom with a bunch of 19-year-olds. So having that diversity in the classroom already makes it a lot more attractive. Another example of that is, you know, as I mentioned, we started out in 46 to serve returning veterans. And now with the new GI Bill, we are again reemphasizing those historical roots. We have huge numbers of returning veterans on campus. We have appointed a new veteran services coordinator. So we are able in a dedicated space to help the veterans get certified for their veteran status so they can get their benefits, and also help them with all the other things that they need to do. And I think that's a group that we know often needs a little bit of extra help because of the experiences that they have gone through for them to succeed.
Vim, it's always good to talk with you. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you very much, Carol.
Vim Vivel is president of Portland State University. And now for the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
After much controversy and years of delays, the Atlantic Yards project in Brooklyn appears to be moving forward. The New York State Court of Appeals ruled recently that the state can use its eminent domain powers to seize private property to enable development of the 22-acre project. Sited on a former rail yard, the proposed Atlantic Yards project includes 16 high-rises with more than 6,000 apartment units and a new 18,000-seat arena for the New Jersey Nets basketball team. The New York Times reports that the 6-1 ruling by the appeals court backs up the state's assessment that the land can be considered blighted, clearing the way for the acquisition of that land from a few landowners who are holding out. Opponents have bemoaned the project and this new ruling, arguing that the state is taking private property for private benefit rather than the public good. Though opponents plan to fight the decision, the Atlantic Yards project now seems almost guaranteed to go through. And out in Las Vegas, another mega project is revealing itself to the public this month. The massive 18 million square foot city center on the Las Vegas Strip will have its grand opening this month, with three of its four hotels and a shopping center cutting ribbons. Articles from Fast Company, the Los Angeles Times, and the Philadelphia Inquirer look at the project and what it could mean for the city. As the only major project to complete construction in Las Vegas this year, City Center is seen as both a last gasp for the struggling desert city and a sign of hope for the future. The project takes a very un-Vegas approach to development, aiming at a dense urban feel. Big-name architects like Daniel Libeskind, Rafael Vignoli, and Norman Foster all have buildings in the mix, and the project's intended walkability offer a decidedly different approach to development in a city known for excess and extravagance. Though the design may earn City Center international praise, how well it serves the city's crumbling economy remains to be seen. And finally, inner-city transit advocates have been thrown a bone by the U.S. Department of Transportation. Secretary Ray LaHood recently announced plans to award $280 million worth of grants to cities looking to build and expand bus and streetcar networks. StreetsBlog reports on the announcement, which LaHood made in New Orleans, a city that is working on expanding its historic streetcar system. Cities like New Orleans could be awarded up to $25 million for their transit expansion plans through the new grant program, and funding is expected to roll out as early as this spring. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Coming up after the break, we'll find out about urban agriculture and how pioneers in post-Katrina New Orleans are growing their own food. I'm Carol Coletta. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Tucked into a small corner in mid-city New Orleans is the Little Sparrow Farm. Built on a derelict lot, the farm now provides a wealth of fresh produce for local restaurants and markets all over New Orleans, and is an excellent example of what's known as urban farming. The caretaker of that lot, Marilyn Yank, is also co-founder of the New Orleans Food and Farm Network, a group of urban growers who are using abandoned spaces in the city to grow fresh food. Marilyn, is urban farming something real and significant in terms of the food supply, or is it more wishful thinking?
I think that, like, wishful thinking is an interesting term to use. I think we're at the beginning of a movement that has a lot of hope and wishes, yes, for it to become a bigger movement. So yeah, it's a dream for sure. And like I said, it really will require a concerted effort from city officials really seeing it as a viable option for city rebirth. And, you know, those things will include city planner, urban planners. It will include places to sell. It will include training for growers. It's a whole sort of system that it'll require for urban farming to really take hold. And certainly now I would say it is sort of a patchwork system of dedicated and passionate people that needs a lot more networking and knitting together to really make it a really viable movement within our cities.
You talked about urban officials needing to understand and support this. How would they do that? What sort of support do you need?
Well, one thing I want to clarify too is I really like to use the word urban agriculture and urban farming as a part of urban agriculture. And urban agriculture really to me includes backyard gardens, community gardens, market gardens, and the more micro farming situation. So, you know, we should probably clarify that. you know, my interest is really in the increase of urban agriculture. Personally, I am an urban farmer, but urban agriculture does encompass all those things. And so for a city to really, you know, get behind and support, in each of those categories, there are different ways to support. As a micro farmer, zoning, things around zoning, support in selling, reducing hindrances to me being able to sell. Currently on the books here in New Orleans, there's a very old, you know, probably from the 60s, 70s, a zoning code that if you're growing on under 5 acres, you're not permitted to sell. Well, that doesn't make sense on an urban level. You know, most of us are growing on under a quarter of an acre. So really looking at things like that, zoning codes and the, you know, permitting process, like really speeding that up, providing small grants, if that is something that a city really wants to see happen. You know, it's a little chunk of money to get going. It's a little granting process that would happen, training. So a variety of things would support the movement and happening in a bigger way.
Let me ask you this. In a perfect world, if you could realize the dream of urban agriculture, what percentage of the food supply, a local food supply, could realistically come from urban agriculture in the local community?
Yeah, I think that depends on a couple of things. The skills of the growers. I grow on a lot right now that's 30 by 100. That's a very typical New Orleans city lot size. If I were growing just solely from my neighbors and I wanted to grow a variety of things, I could probably support year-round like 4 families of 4. So on my one city lot, really with my skills, building my skills, you know, that could happen for a family of 4. Now, in the city of New Orleans, we have tens of thousands, and I really hate to say hundreds of thousands, although that number has been quoted to me, of vacant city lots. So, you know, if you can think of my one city lot and sort of multiply that as to the possibilities of what could happen, that's tremendous.
That would be impressive. You've been called an urban farmer. Where did you get that title?
Well, you know, you could call what I do a market garden, but really I think the thing that changes me from being a gardener into a farmer is that I actively search out markets to sell. So what I'm doing is not just for my own household, but really looking to make it somewhat of a viable financial situation by selling.
So you hope to support yourself and provide yourself a decent income through urban agriculture?
That requires a certain skill level. Now, I'm, you know, have been growing for a number of years, but at this scale, only for the last couple of years. And as my skill level grows, I see that my profits increase. I have a friend here in town who's been doing this for 8 to 12 years. And he has really gotten it down so that in his peak growing season and with a green market here that will take whatever he sells, which is a really important component of this piece of urban agriculture, are the markets that will take what we grow as small growers because we don't have the quantity like the rural farmers. You know, there were weeks when, you know, he was $500 a week. Now, that's not the sole family income, and I've never promoted it as that. You know, I think it's a great second income into a family, either for a mom whose kids go to school during the day, or an elder, or some teens that want to come together and do that as a project. You know, I don't see it as a primary family income, but it certainly could be a supportive second income to a family and also provide fresh, beautiful food to the household.
Tell me about your farm. It's just a couple of blocks from your house in Mid-City, New Orleans?
Yeah. The farm that I grow on is, like I said, it's a city lot. It's about 3 blocks from my house, so I can walk there, which I think is a really important piece in this urban agricultural piece, is to be able to get easily to the piece of land that you're growing on. It is in Mid-City, which is literally in the middle of New Orleans, a neighborhood that's very mixed economically, very mixed racially, very mixed as between renters and homeowners. So a very diverse community. The lot is adjacent to the home of the man who owns it, and it had been not utilized since the 1950s. It was a small movie theaters in the 50s. It burnt down and hasn't been anything since. Prior to Katrina, that was a very known drug dealing corner. And across the street from my garden was a corner store, mostly cigarettes and alcohol. Last year, that store was converted into a small breakfast restaurant. And they knew of my interest and approached me into setting up the garden across the street from their restaurant. So It's a very, very different corner than it was pre-Katrina.
Are there a number of similar city farms now in New Orleans?
It's a very blossoming movement here. I have, for the last several years, worked for the New Orleans Food and Farm Network, and it's one of our initiatives is urban farming. And I see that effort being picked up by organizations all through the city. And the piece of urban agriculture, you know, when we're looking at redeveloping neighborhoods, you know, people really thinking about including that piece, urban agriculture. And so there are, I would say, you know, a handful of people like me growing on the scale I'm growing on and really determined to make it financially somewhat of a viable option for themselves and their households. And I think that that's going to continue to grow. There's just a real blooming interest in that right now here.
What do you attribute that to? I mean, farming's hard work. What is it that you and others are finding appealing about this?
Well, you know, it's a vocation. It's not for everybody. It is hard work. And, you know, a year ago I started this garden from, you know, just a grass lot. And took a month off this summer to do some traveling to visit family, came back. You know, we live in this tropical environment here, and I had, like, weeds literally chest high, and I had that moment of, like, what am I thinking? You know, this is hard work, and it's a vocation. So a lot of people are going to pick it up because, you know, it's the thing right now. There's just a lot of buzz around it. And it will sift out those who really see it as a calling, and it's a wonderful thing to do, but it definitely is not for everybody. And I have friends, you know, who decided this is what they were going to do and pulled up all the grass in their own backyard and, you know, put down, you know, the vegetables and then just said, you know what, I'm going to go to the farmer market and get my produce. Or a man down the street from where I garden, you know, who brought me his tomato plants at the beginning of spring this past year and said, would you like these? And I was like, well, don't you want to grow those? And he was like, no, that's your job. And it was like, okay, all right, that's great. I can see, you know, that it really isn't for everybody. And for some of us, it's just what we want to do.
And that makes sense to me. But there are all of a sudden so many people who want to do it compared to 3 years ago. Why has this burst onto the scene suddenly?
I think it's a convergence of a lot of movements right now. I think that between the Green Jobs Initiative that's happening, the local food movement, the social justice movements, the links between health and diet, what we all know is the inequalities of grocery store placement in low-income neighborhoods, young people interested in farming and rural land not being available like it was in the past, and seeing that this is a viable option is to really farm in the cities. And at the same time, also for young people, like sort of that interest of living in an urban community and still being able to do farming. It's a very interesting juxtaposition. And I think it's a very interesting time for young people in this movement, because I think it's a new thing happening. But I really think it's just, like I said, it's a convergence of all these things happening at the same time. And certainly this urban farming movement came out of the community garden movement of the 70s, you know, and there was a lot of people doing community garden movements. Now that's kind of died back a little bit, and this urban farming movement is coming up in a different way, but it is certainly seems like it's just sort of time for it.
What are the real differences between today's movement of urban agriculture and the 70s movement in community gardens?
I think what people have found with community gardens, and, you know, certainly what we have found here, is that unless something is like right in your backyard, and that's one of the reasons New Orleans Food and Farm Network has put a lot of effort into creating, helping people create backyard gardens. And it's hard enough to work your job or your two jobs and then come home and pick up your tools and, you know, walk down a couple blocks to go to your community garden. But if it's in your backyard, it's going to make a big difference. So it's just a different emphasis now than it was then. It's just people have different lives. We're moving at a much faster pace even than we were in the 70s. So having things a little more closer to home make it easier.
You mentioned social justice as one of these converging movements. Certainly social justice has been an issue, but renamed and made more specific around food justice is a relatively new issue. Again, where did that come from?
Well, the food justice movement really is a pretty new movement, I would say, in the last 12 to 15 years. And it came it came from the hunger. It came out of, it arose out of the hunger movement of food banks and making sure everybody got food. Then the next step was, well, how do we put tools into the hands of people so it's not just giving people food and, you know, food that, you know, other people might not have wanted, but really adding dignity to that and being able to give people the tools and the access to food rather than just the handout. So about 12 to 15 years ago, you know, there, you know, it was really a group of people who came together to really think about these issues. And there is a national coalition called the Community Food Security Coalition, which were really the forerunners in this country to start looking at those issues and to start thinking beyond food banks and to start thinking about different avenues for increasing fresh food access to our communities. And urban agriculture is only one of those arms, but certainly the one that seems to be getting a lot of press and attention these days.
I want to come back to something you said earlier, Marilyn. You talked about as the skill level, as your skill level as a farmer improves, you can produce more. I don't know enough about farming to know. What does that really mean, increasing your skill level? What skills do you have to improve to make your farm more productive?
Management. You know, last year when I started this, you know, I just wanted to grow everything. And so I had a little bit of everything. But a little bit of everything didn't allow me really any markets because I didn't really have enough to really do more than a few, my own family household and a few other friends. So this year, like, I'm really just focusing on a couple things. I'm focusing on a few crops, growing more. You know, the restaurant across the street, you know, was willing last year to take all the microgreens that I could grow. Well, I'd only dedicated a few beds and their volume increased, you know, I just couldn't keep up with them. This year, I know I need to dedicate more of my garden to just a few crops that, you know, will be attractive to someone who needs a significant amount of something. At the same time, I want to provide things that my neighbors want in that neighborhood. So, you know, I'm making sure that I have a couple good rows of collards and carrots, that the kids love that. So I'm really trying to find that balance of finding the cash crops for myself. And that really is about sort of management and skills around knowing how to grow a couple of crops, a couple of high dollar crops, you know, and balancing that with things that are interesting and usable to people right in my immediate community there.
What changes in habits will it require for fresh food to become normal?
You know, I think our biggest avenue here is in our schools. There is, in the food justice movement now, along with this bursting urban agriculture that you're seeing everywhere, the school food movement, that the movement to get fresh foods into our schools and get the health, the unhealthy food out. So I think you're going to be seeing, and you're probably already seeing, a lot of things written, initiatives happening around school food, and both in, you know, getting that fresh food into the neighborhoods, into the school in our school neighborhoods, and making that connection with our local farmers. So it, you know, it starts to be this win-win situation. And again, you know, we're talking about volume, like how can we get that volume to support schools? You know, it's happening really a lot at the university level, because there's, you know, sort of a demand by university students that they want that. So it's happening a lot there at that level, and it's beginning to happen more at the school level and will require, like, parents to get involved and, you know, really the whole community to get involved. Whether you have children in schools or not, I think that that's really important place to put our efforts.
Of course, when they come out of the garden, then, you know, then you have to do something with them in the kitchen. And a lot of people simply don't know how to cook these days. So what do you do to encourage people to learn to cook again?
So cooking, you know, in the food justice movement, cooking was one of the first things that sort of came on the radar, you know, and it's one of the projects that I was involved in 10 years ago, which was the creation of a food education and cooking class for low-income families using fresh seasonal produce. This was back in Austin, Texas, about 10 years ago. So that has been a thread throughout. You know, really today, like here in New Orleans, it's not that we don't know how to cook here. It's sort of a remembering and a bringing in, like I really think that for this to be really be effective is to bring the elders back into the picture. And, you know, there is beautiful food that's produced here, and it just needs to be tweaked a little bit to make it a little healthier. And so one way to really encourage that is to, not for me to go out there and teach people how to cook, but to really encourage our elders, maybe train our elders, you know, the people here who, you know, really hold the tradition, to tweak those recipes a little bit and to share that, you know, with the youth. And I love that connection of really, that line of connection between the elders and the youth. I think that's a really important one to keep alive in this movement in general, particularly here, like in the South. Like, there is so much growing information that I could benefit from the people who have been doing it for generations here. So I think definitely cooking is a really important piece and is something all of us have sort of stopped doing a lot of.
Marilyn, can you explain the dynamics of a local farmers market? How they're founded, how they're run, what the economics are?
So the dynamics of local farmers markets. I think in every community it's different who the organizing body is for the farmers market. And that's a very, very critical piece, is who the organizing body is, because it's a tremendous amount of organization and facilitation to make for a successful farmers market. Sometimes it's a nonprofit, sometimes it's a small for-profit, and sometimes the farmers themselves organize themselves into a farmer's market. But then that gets just another whole level to their already huge load of work that they have to do to get the food to the market. As I said, there are some farmer-run farmers markets. And as far as the benefits for the farmers and the economics for the farmer, it's one avenue, and for some farmers, a very good avenue to sell their wares. It's not for every farmer. Not every farmer wants to do what it takes to bring to market, to be able to set up, present, keep things fresh and beautiful for 4 to 5 hours on a Saturday. But for those who choose to, and, you know, the proof is really in the pudding, so to speak, because they keep coming back and, you know, it becomes a very viable and important part of their marketing strategy. And most farmers have several avenues of, you know, marketing strategies. Usually just one isn't good to depend on, just one, which some of our farmers saw, you know, when with Katrina here, in that, you know, one day we had farmers markets, the next day they didn't, and they lost a significant market. So it's really good to have a diverse marketing strategy as a farmer.
What can our listeners do to support the local food, fresh food, urban agriculture movement?
I think that everybody, as I said earlier, whether or not you have children, get involved in school food initiatives. It is definitely the topic of the day. Demand it in your schools. That our children should be eating healthy foods. There's tremendous amount of documentation about how eating and eating well helps children to learn and improves behavior in the classroom. So get behind that. Support your local farmers market. Encourage and support your local growers in any way that you can. Support local nonprofit organizations in your community that are promoting local food access, food justice, that are doing policy work, get behind policy work that supports these issues. And maybe first and foremost, sit down and eat with your family and friends as often as you can. I think that we have really lost the beauty of what it means to sit around a dinner table together. And I think so much of our social ills could be healed by sitting down to eat together more often.
Thanks, Marilyn, for being our guest on Smart City.
So thank you, Carol. It's been a real pleasure and a wonderful opportunity to speak about something I feel a lot of passion for. Thank you.
Marilyn Yake is the caretaker of the Little Sparrow Farm and advises the New Orleans Food and Farm Network. Finally, this week, our City Views commentator Walker Smith has a bolt of inspiration about how certain events may not be so rare.
A friend of my mother's always seemed to win drawings or sweepstakes. Her biggest prize was the station wagon she won in a contest sponsored by a local grocery store. It just seemed uncanny, but whether it was a junior league raffle or bingo, her number always came up. It was like that old saying about lightning striking twice. It made her seem special. Of course, it turns out that lightning striking twice is not as unusual as you would think. Indeed, lightning strikes some places over and over again. The launch pad at Cape Canaveral is hit by lightning on a regular basis. The Empire State Building is hit by lightning an average of 25 times a year. Well, of course, you say, these are tall buildings and one would expect that, but that doesn't have anything to do with people. Well, don't tell that to U.S. Park Ranger Roy Sullivan. While working in the Shenandoah National Park in Virginia between 1942 and 1977, he was hit by lightning 7 times and survived them all. In fact, the real number is probably 8. Sullivan claimed to have also been hit by lightning as a child, but couldn't independently verify it. Even Sullivan's wife was hit once by lightning while hanging clothes in their backyard. Sullivan was helping her, so who knows, maybe the lightning just missed that time. Indeed, events we think are rare aren't really all that unusual. If there is a 1 in a million chance of something happening on any given day, in a world of nearly 7 billion people, that means that event should happen 7,000 times each day. That's 7,000 1 in a million events every single day. What seems rare to us individually is really not all that unusual. There was a Newsweek cover story this past summer that proclaimed with big block letters, "Aliens exist." Why? Well, because of the numbers. Scientists now estimate that half of the 200 billion suns in the Milky Way, our galaxy, have Earth-like planets circling them. Of this number, the odds are pretty high that some will have the right kind of atmosphere, temperature, and resources to support intelligent life. If the odds are even as high as 1 in 100 billion, that means one other planet in our galaxy is home to aliens. And that's just our galaxy. In the observable universe, there are 80 billion galaxies. The entire universe is 10 to the 23rd power to 10 to the 26th power as large as the observable universe. If you ask me, the odds are we are not alone. It really doesn't take a belief in magic or mysticism to realize that unusual, improbable, even far-fetched events occur regularly. The supernatural is, in fact, the everyday. What's breathtaking in its rarity is, in the bigger scheme of things, mundane in its predictability. But this isn't to suggest that these sorts of things are not special. It is only to remind ourselves that we don't have to be struck dumb to be amazed and enchanted by the extraordinary beauty and enchantment of the incredible things that happen all around us with regularity. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is the president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us each week from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. There's more Smart City for you online. Go to smartcityradio.com where you can download past shows, sign up for our newsletter, and get links to our guest work. You can also subscribe to our podcast and have Smart City delivered straight to you. You can also get in touch with us by clicking on the contact button or send email to questions@smartcityradio.com. Our web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. I'm Carol Coletta.